salta mi jale, jaleya, uy, uy, jule, jaleya.
Welcome to the California Indian Radio Project. This program is Honoring the Women.
The only reason we are still here as Indian people is because of the women. We control the knowledge, we control the stories, we own the children.
They said, oh, the women have nothing to say for them, the Indian. He said, the only way they do is walk behind. I said, not in Korea, they didn't. Not in Korea. I said, I think they ruled everything, even behind doors, you know.
I recently gave a paper in Santa Barbara, and I had a young man approach me and say, but I thought Indian men enslaved their wives. And I looked at him and I said, young man, it's apparent you've never been married to a California Indian woman.
Over the past three centuries, California Indian women have witnessed vast changes in their communities. Enduring the invasions of the Spanish, Russians, and Americans, they have worked hard to make sure that their families, communities, and cultures would continue to exist. In contemporary Indian society, some women have taken on the job of tribal chair or other highly visible roles. Some women are healers and teachers, while other women prefer to work behind the scenes. They are all respected and acknowledged within their communities, but often little known outside of the Indian world. I'm Neil Harvey. In this program, we honor these women, their strength, courage, caring, and wisdom. Producer Susan Newstead introduces us to some outstanding California women.
Susan Lobo is a cultural anthropologist who has lived and worked in California Indian communities since she was very young.
In California, Indian women play very strong roles, not only in the family setting, but across the community setting. Many, many California Indian women were and continue today to be those who get the work done and take on very, very powerful roles in the community and are seen this way and appreciated and respected because they are strong people and intelligent people and active and vital people. And these women had tremendous respect in the communities, but it wasn't recorded historically because the bias was really in the eyes of the beholder, that is those historians or early anthropologists who were almost exclusively men who failed to understand the nature of the power that these women had.
Ed Castillo, Kawiya, and Luceño, and professor of Native Studies at Sonoma State, has been researching some of the strong Indian women whose lives provide inspiration. Two such heroines are Juana Maria of San Nicolas Island and Toy Purina, a Tongva doctor who lived in the San Gabriel Valley. Ed tells the story of Toy Purina.
Toy Purina's story really begins in October of 1781 when the Spanish established their authority in San Gabriel Valley of Southern California. There they organized the Mission San Gabriel, and its impact on the local Indians was great. One of the most lasting impacts was the introduction of both European diseases and domestic animals. They were destroying their habitat, making it impossible for people to live off of territories that formerly supported them very well, and eventually was dragging Indians into this labor system in order to feed themselves. And it is probably the growing economic crisis that resulted from this contact that brought Toy Purina to the point where she was willing to act in conjunction with a discontented mission Indian by the name of Nicolas Jose, another Tongva man, in organizing a plot to destroy the missionaries in the year 1785. She was an Indian doctor, and she was powerful and respected. So Toy Purina organized eight villages, although not all the villages committed all of their warriors to this enterprise, and proceeded to inaugurate a plan to destroy the missionaries. The plot had been discovered, however, by a Spanish soldier who spoke the Tongva language. He had overheard two of the mission Indians talking about the impending attack, and a trap was set for the Indians. About 25 of them scaled the walls and were captured without actually any violence. They were surprised, disarmed, and put on trial. Toypurina was exiled to the most distant mission for life. In fact, she suffered almost a year and a half of total isolation in a cell before her disposition was made. She was sent to Monterey. She lived the remaining 10 years of her young life. She died at the age of 43 and is buried at Mission San Juan Bautista.
Over 50 years later, the woman who came to be called Juana Maria demonstrated another kind of strength. She was isolated from other human beings for 18 years after being left alone on San Nicolas Island. She used the creativity, earth skills, and vast inner resources of indigenous culture to thrive.
She's known in popular culture as the lone woman on San Nicolas Island. Scott O'Dell in the 1950s wrote a children's book about her called The Island of Blue Dolphins. And in 1964, Universal Studios made a equally sanitized film about her experiences. The accounts differ of how she was isolated there. But during these years, she lived in isolation. She completely maintained herself with her traditional knowledge of collecting foods, killing of sea mammals, birds, and others. She was found in 1853 by Captain George Nitiver, who was asked by a Spanish padre to search for this woman on the island. And he, along with several ex-neophyte mission Indians, probably Chumash people from Santa Barbara, combed the island and came upon her. She spoke to the Indians that accompanied George Nitiver. They couldn't understand her. When it was apparent by signs that they were going to take her off the island, she willingly left the island and was brought to the mainland.
The padres and other scholars were fascinated by this woman. They baptized her and gave her the name Juana Maria. Native speakers traveled from many different areas to speak to her.
At least one informant was brought from Mission San Fernando who spoke to her and could discern some of her words. Four of the words that have been written down clearly indicate she spoke a different dialect than the Santa Barbara Indians. Unfortunately, we have one of her songs remembered by Fernando Labrado.
This recording of Fernando Labrado was originally made on a wax cylinder in 1913 by John P. Harrington. Juana Maria died within 7 weeks of being taken from the island. Yet her legacy is fundamentally one of resiliency and survival. California Indian women pay close attention to all of the information flowing around the community. Susan Lobo.
Information travels around in the community, and it travels real fast, and people know all the details about what's going on almost immediately after anything has happened, because it's like there's a pool or a stream of information that's always flowing, and it's this vital information about what's going on in the community and what's going on in people's lives. It's women who keep on top of this and keep track of how things are going so that things can go along in the right way.
These women have used many other talents to help things go along in the right way. Some of them have healed illnesses, guided their people, and sought to build understanding for Native ways among non-Natives. Essie Parrish did all of these and more. She was a healer, prophet, basket maker, and major linguistic informant for the Kashaya Pomo people who live on the Sonoma County coast in Northern California. Her daughter, Bernice Torres, who was also a healer, remembered that Essie could perform miracles.
In 1949, I was working for this lady in Ukiah, and she says, I want to ask you something, if you know any kind of herbs or something that I could take, because the doctors had told her that she had cancer. And she says, I don't want to die. And we were very good friends by then. And so I told this lady, if you could humble yourself and if you think you can go up to the reservation and lie down in my mother's bed I said, she just received a miracle song. Maybe she could do something for you. And I told her what she should do and that she should give her a gift or groceries or money or whatever it's worth to her. So 3 days later, they had a specialist lined up from San Diego to perform the surgery. There were five doctors that had confirmed that she had cancer. So they went in there and they performed the surgery, but they didn't find any cancer. And then so he asked her, he said, what did you do in the meantime? There was only 3 days between her surgery and the time she went up there. And she said, I guess it was prayer.
Essie recorded that song in 1958. Indian healers each have a particular gift or gifts that determine their method of healing. Essie had several gifts. In addition to receiving miracle songs, she was a sucking doctor, literally sucking the sickness out of the patient and into her own throat, from which that sickness was then removed. She could talk to the illness, pluck out the disease with her hand, and could also see inside her patient's body. Bernice Torres explains.
She could see, just like we can see out the window, we can see those trees, we can see them move and everything. And she said that's the way it was, that she could see inside. If there's something wrong with your intestines or whatever, she could see that spot there. And it revealed itself, what it was, what type of disease it was and all that.
Bernice often assisted her mother in healing work, along with other qualified helpers. They would perform certain songs or dances at the appropriate time.
Just like a surgeon having an experienced and well-trained nurses there at surgery, you know, when they say, sing this song, we have to know that particular song. And just like the doctor will, they'll hand those scalpels and things into their hand while they're performing surgery. That's what we have to do too with the songs. We have to know when to act. We have to know what to say. We have to know what to sing. And that's the way it worked. Of course, the head helper has to know everything.
Essie's gifts went beyond healing her people. She worked with Dr. Robert Oswald and Herman James to preserve the Kashaya Pomo language. She was an accomplished basket weaver. In addition, she was a prophet who guided the Kashaya with her visions. And she traveled throughout North America, helping non-Native people understand Native culture.
She was almost always away in her older age. Of course, doctoring was the greatest thing that she has ever done, was to heal the people. That was her mission. She was instructed when she was very, very young that she was a doctor. And for her not to say no whenever anybody called for a prayer or singing or whatever, when they were ill.
Like her mother, Bernice devoted much of her life to healing. She lived most of her adult life in the Monterey Bay area. Recently, she found renewed interest in the traditional songs and dances among her own people.
The younger people have said to me, come home. And I said, well, why should I come home? They all fell away from the old religion anyway. And they said, well, we didn't. That was our parents. So there's a sort of a revival going on. So I'm teaching them the songs and teaching them the dance whenever I could. And my mom's been dead for 16 years. And this was the first year that we had the Strawberry and Flower Festival here in this area. They want to learn. It's just that they don't have too many elders to coach them.
Bernice Torres was featured in Grand Avenue, a made-for-HBO movie about three Pomo families filmed in Santa Rosa, California. She died shortly after its release in the fall of 1996. One of the most vital roles California indigenous women have assumed is that of protector and transmitter of culture. Catherine Siva Sobel is a Kawiya elder from Southern California who is fulfilling this responsibility in powerful ways. An important Kawiya linguistic informant, ethnobotanist, and author, she co-founded the first all-Indian-controlled museum and publishes a scholarly journal. Catherine is a vigorous advocate for California indigenous environmental and human rights. What motivates her in all these endeavors, she says, is her concern for future generations.
The children have to have something good going for them, you know. When I do things like that, I think about my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, and then probably in about 7 years, I'll have a great-great-grandchild, you know. So you have to preserve something for them, you know, because they will be just lost if you don't do those things for them.
Lowell Bean is one of California's most highly respected anthropologists and has worked with Catherine Sobel for many years.
Her primary contribution was as a keeper of traditional ways. She had a sense, as a young woman, of retaining cultural history and communicating it to others. Given different circumstances and times, she probably would have been a PhD scholar or that sort of thing. At the time she was a young woman, of course, that was very difficult and probably not possible.
I understood when I was in grammar school that things were not going to be the same in the future. Maybe that's why I was so inquisitive to learn about how our past was, you know, from my grandmother. Because I realized that a lot of the Indians, boys and girls that went to school with me, I would talk to them in Kawiya, and they answered me back in English. So I said, this is what's going to happen in the future to myself. I said, our language will be gone, which is almost going now, see. And most of the people don't talk the language, and they can't sing the songs. And that's one of the things that always disturbed me, because once you lose your language, you lose everything. You can't interpret your songs, you can't interpret anything. Your stories are gone.
That Kawiya creation song was sung by Catherine's brother Alvino Siva, who has been working to preserve their songs. Catherine's concern for the survival of the Kawiya language led her to work with linguists and to be exposed to the field of anthropology and its methods. Lowell Bean.
Bill Bright began to bring her to UCLA to serve as a linguistic informant for linguistic classes. And while she was there, she sat in anthropology classes in the department, so she became very familiar with what anthropologists were doing and could do, and made some judgments about how this would work for her dreams about retaining Kawiya culture or recording it.
As in most traditional cultures, Kawiya men and women's roles were separately defined and provided balance for each other. As non-native culture became predominant, however, this balance shifted, and women were increasingly called upon to assume positions normally reserved for men. Lowell Bean.
At various times in Kawiya history, women have, for one reason or another, had to assume very strong or dominant positions, and when the need was there for them to do it, they did it. When World War II came along, for example, the men went away to war, and the women had to step into formal political roles that they rarely did before. And as early as the 1890s, you see them stepping into religious roles, which would not have been possible before.
Catherine worked with Jane Pablo Penn, another strong Kawiya woman, to found Malki Museum. To generate revenue for the museum, they experimented with publishing. Later, Catherine and Lowell Bean co-authored Temalpach, a book about plants that Kawiya people have used.
We have our own press, we have our own books, and we tell our own stories. You know, there's some books here written by Indian people themselves. So it's very mm-hmm. important. I think we're on our 32nd publication okay. of different books. Temmelbach itself is going into a sixth publication.
Here's a perfect example of these women being culture bearers.
Ed Castillo.
These are the people who are bridging the gaps between non-Indian society and Indian society. And, you know, it's one thing for us to want to help ourselves and to cure ourselves and to do it internally, but we cannot do it without taking into account the world around us. And Kathy and many other California Indian women have done this for us. They've shown us how we can do this, maintain our integrity, contribute something to the larger body of knowledge about American Indians to non-Indians, but also be powerful forces for change and maintaining Indian culture within their own communities.
Vivian Hailstone, Yurok, Karuk, and a member of the Hoopa tribe, is an educator, artist, and human rights activist who often finds herself before the public eye. This soft-spoken, energetic woman is most comfortable working behind the scenes, organizing and motivating others to work toward a common goal. Genevieve Seeley is Wiat and Vivian's close friend and colleague.
She's a sharing person, and she gets people mm-hmm. to test their own horizons, things that they have never, ever had the courage to do on their own. She will get them to do. That's what we need. We need now, you know, we need people that are willing to take risk. And she'll take the risk. She will. You know, life is too short to sit back there and let it pass you by.
Vivian began school in a one-room schoolhouse near her home. But when she was 10, her family moved to Hoopa, and she had to attend the boarding school there.
We lived not far from the school, but they kept us there over weekends because if we went home, we would be singing our songs again. We would be speaking our language. And now I understand they wanted to get the Indian out of us and make us into something else, which I think followed up many, many people. I remember my brother-in-law was singing a song behind one of the big buildings, he and another boy. They were singing a drum song, and they were caught, and they were strapped.
When her father became a trustee of the school, he worked with the administration to create a day school so the children could live at home. Vivian's own difficult education contributed to her desire to co-found, with Genevieve Seeley, a support group in Redding called LIFE, Local Indians for Education. Genevieve Seeley.
Local Indians for Education started about 1972. And we just were a group of people that were concerned because the schools were not doing a good job. And there was one school up in eastern Shasta County, they had never had an Indian graduate out of high school. It's appalling. And it was Indian country, so we thought we'd do something about it. And we started teaching.
We do a lot of things. We work on curriculum. We go into the schools. We have teacher workshops. And we started a store so the Indian people could have a place to sell their wares. And this has been going on for about 10 years. And we teach classes on crafts. It's not only education, it's community development or people development. And it's been great, and it's going great even now.
Another people development project Vivian started is the week-long Youth and Elders Project, held each year at DQU. It helps young Indian people find the strength to survive in the outside world.
Vivian started the idea of the youth and elders. Elders are getting fewer and fewer, and young people are not learning what they need to learn and to survive. And we bring the young people in, and the older people come and teach them things, you know, philosophy and crafts and just survival skills and respect. Respect for older people, respect for themselves, respect for the earth, respect for everybody. And it's made them stronger people.
One message that Vivian carries in her work is that all authentic culture, including Native American, change and evolve. When she was appointed to the Advisory Commission for California Parks and Recreation, she used her position to update the public image of indigenous Californians, as in the following example from Patrick's Point.
they had a display there, and they had an electric stove with a stainless steel pot on it, and they said, this is how we do it. And then they had an acorn basket with some stones and a paddle, and it said, this is how Indians do it. And then they had a chainsaw there, and it said, this is how we do it. And then they had a wedge and a pounding thing there, and it says, this is how Indians do it. And I cook on an electric stove. I have stainless steel pots. And my brother was one of the first people who bought a chainsaw. So I talked to the people in charge, and they said, we can't change this. Sacramento sets this up. So then I happened to be on the advisory board to the State Parks and Recreation, and I went down there to the meeting and told them about it. And I said, if they're not going to change it, we're going to march. We're going to... write letters, we're going to be really active, and so they did change it.
When I was 16 years old, going to high school, I was raised in Palm Springs, and there was a restaurant right next door to us. I've been fighting forever, it seemed like. And I looked over there, and on the window it said, catering to whites only. And boy, my hair just went up, you know. I just turned around, went into the restaurant, and asked that manager, the man. I said, where do you have that notice there on the window? He just looked at me. I said, if you want to put that up, go across to Palm Canyon Drive. That's the side where the white man is. And then you can cater to him. But I said, you are right on an Indian reservation. And the old man never said anything, just turned around. I went on to school. I came back that evening. That was gone.
These women we have profiled are but a few of the thousands of California Indian women who combine careers with raising families while being active within their communities. Like their mothers and grandmothers before them, they work hard to assure the continuity of their people. For the California Indian Radio Project, I'm Susan Newstead.
Honoring the Women. This program was written and produced by Susan Newstead. Executive producer, Peggy Berryhill. Project director, Roby Cook. Production assistants, Francis Slack Rayside. Digital editing and mixing, Neil Harvey. Thanks to Alvino Siva and Buffy St. Marie for the use of their songs and music. Thanks to the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History for the recording of the Juana Maria song. And to the California Library Collection for the use of the songs by Essie Parrish and Bill Graves. The music of Koljodimo appears in the opening theme. This program is a project of Northern California Cultural Communications, with funds provided by the California Council for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Lannan Foundation, the Leff Foundation, the Vanguard Public Foundation, the Seventh Generation Fund, the Fund for Folk Culture in partnership with the James Irvine Foundation, and the SEVA Foundation. For the California Indian Radio Project, I'm Neil Harvey.
To order a cassette tape of this program or a resource guide with more information about the people and topics we've covered, call 1-800-461-3991. That's 1-800-461-3991. Or visit our website at flickerfeather.org.
This program is distributed by the American Indian Radio on satellite, a service of Native American Public Telecommunications.